Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Lawrence Drank, also known as Sparky Lee, is back with us today along with his guest. Sparky will be doing the hosting. We're having some kind of interference in the background. Lawrence, take over.
Okay. Hey, if anybody has background noise, can you please mute yourself right now if you're not speaking? Okay. Go ahead, Leona. All right, so we're getting some feedback noise. Can everybody mute themselves?
Brady's mute.
Okay, Lawrence is going to be introducing his guest, Anthony McGee, also from California, someone who was severely abused as a child as well. He's going to be introducing Grady, his brother, and he's going to be introducing a few others, and I'm going to let him take over now. And again, if anybody can, please either mute or whatever the noise is in the background, just get rid of it. Go ahead. Sorry.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to a beautiful Sunday afternoon or, you know, evening where you're at, depending on that. I just want to welcome today's guest. We have Melissa from the Warrior Within Project. We have my brother, Tom Brady, which he's an associate of Legacy Programs. We have Jamie, of course, and we have Anthony McGee and Star Coates as well, which she does Power Panel 365. And today I just really wanted to give everybody their voice and to put the most information out there that we can for others that need help or for us to put out our cause and what we're doing so we allow those people to help us. And so I just want to welcome everybody, and we will start off with I want to introduce first Anthony McGee. And then after that, I want to introduce Star, what she's doing. She runs a very powerful project that she's a big part of. And I believe you're the director of that, right? So,
yes.
And then we will then have Melissa, and she will go further into what she's doing. And then Jamie, of course. So I just want to welcome everybody. So Anthony, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes. My name is Anthony McGee. I'm just been released from federal custody after pretty close to 9 years off a 15-year sentence under the compassionate release vehicle. And prior to that, I did 7 years in the, well, 6 years and 9 months in the California Department of Corrections. And then about another 6 years and 7 months in the California Youth Authority. And I went to Vision Quest, which is a placement home in my juvenile time, Optimus Boys Home, Boys Republic, a couple of group homes, camp, and, you know, juvenile hall. So that's been my life for the past 25 years out of 44 years. And go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask, so what are some of the issues? And if anyone has any comments or questions, feel free to ask Anthony anything.
Yeah, because
I know we have a lot of people on today, but we're going to get to try to get everybody's voice heard and any anything commented on or questions answered. But, you know, one of the things we talk about is the further effects of incarceration, how mass incarceration and the lack of rehabilitation and the dehumanization within the system. And how is that affecting you today?
Oh, well, for starters, if you want to take it from the perspective of making a transition back into society, or are you looking at the element of how you conditioned yourself to interact with society because you've been incarcerated, and so everything that you do is based on policy and not natural responses. It's based on administrative directives. All of those things take effect on you psychologically, and you tend to view life from that lens. So when you get out and try to make a transition back into society, the rest of the populace is not aware of your current means to actually interact. But the probation or parole, they're expecting you to integrate and to have this disposition that, you know, you have to be patient with the process, but the rest of society is not being patient with your process. And so that creates a lot of confusion, and it also creates a lot of, a lot of anxiety and a lot of frustration because you're not able to get things instantaneously like you would as if you were in prison, like, or in a institutional setting where, you know, you have to go here for this appointment and right there they're ready to deal with you and send you back to the unit. You know, you go to chow. Oh, that's the other thing. So, and this is something that I was going over with a lot of guys who I was talking to inside. They put you, institutions in prison put you in a childlike codependency state. You know, as a grown man, you're dealing with a circumstance where your clothing is being provided to you every day. Your food is being provided to you every day. Your lights, electricity, housing, all those things that you'll be responsible for as an adult, these are being provided to you every single day, year in and year out. And you don't have that as a pressing concern on your mind while you're doing that time. But as soon as you get out, all of those responsibilities are heaped upon you at one time. I have to find clothes. I have to find food. I have to find shelter. I have to pay a bill. I have to learn how to pay a bill. I have to learn how to go in and apply for a job to where when you go into prison, those jobs are automatically assigned to you by force. You have to
work in
prison. Yes.
Anthony, can I interrupt you for a minute? Do you have your speaker on? There's a strong echo coming from your phone or your calling.
Let's see. What would I do to
if you have your speaker on, can you try it without the speaker being on?
Let me turn it down. Verse.
I don't hear it now, so I don't know what happened.
You don't hear me at all?
I don't hear the echo now.
Okay. Maybe I was speaking too close to the computer. Are we good now?
Yes.
Okay. So those are the things that one has to face as soon as he gets out, if that addressed the question.
No, absolutely. I think that's I like how you put it. You know, they, like you're childlike. You know, they supply everything for you. You're supposed to work. And though it gives us a good work ethic, we really don't know how to address that when we get out. I mean, I went through the same thing. I've only been out 6 months after a 20-year sentence. So,
yeah.
No, I completely get it. Now, do you have any solutions to these problems or, like, any ideas of how it could be better?
Okay, so again, this is what I see as a recurring problem. Okay, I want to take this back to, let's look at the dynamic. What have they done already that has tried to work? You have a lot of psychoanalysts. You have a lot of think tanks who come in and look at this from a theoretical perspective. Like in theory, You lock these people up. You give them these workshops while they're in there. You throw all this money at these reentry programs. You know what I'm saying? You do all of these different things. And, don't forget the psychologists who have their input. And so what they've done is they've created this vacuum to where we're going to put money in the system and we're going to create a budget for this program and this program and this program. And these guys are going to attend. And so the incentive for the attendance is that you potentially can get some time off your sentence. That's never going to work because I'm not doing this on my own volition. I have what you call a situation where if I can get out early, then that means I'm going to attend this program. Well, they call that surface conforming. You're never internalizing the actual values or the actual concepts that are being given to you through these programs. And even the programs themselves, they don't have any practical application because the nuance here is you've never been locked up. You're only seeing this from a perspective from somebody who's watching somebody become locked up. So there are psychological transitions that you're making while you're in custody that a psychologist can't identify and doesn't have an actual solution for it because you don't see it from that perspective. So this will never work. And you ask me the question, what will work? I'm not sure there is anything that you can do to undo slavery. Huh?
You know, I'm sorry. I would love to say something. My name is Sandy Fries. I am a cognitive behavioral therapist and a neurolinguistic programmer. My business is Victory from Chaos. What I would like to say to you, Anthony, is this. I hear your great pain. And I empathize with you because of that. Have I been incarcerated? No, I have not. Am I a justice advocate? Yes, I am. Was I abused? Yes, greatly abused. I was sexually and physically abused as a child by my preacher father. I was abused again by an ex-husband as an adult. You know, this hurts. And you know, it hurts all of us.
Mm-hmm.
I was in weekly therapy sessions for years. I lived like a zombie. I did not want to get out of bed. When I did get out of bed, I thought all day long, when can I go back to bed? This is trauma at its greatest. And what I think is this, and then I'm going to be quiet. But, you know, I speak with a lot of other justice advocates. I speak with a lot of people who have nonprofit organizations. And we speak about the basic necessities for those reentering society. And they are this. You must have a place to sleep, hopefully, away from triggers and other things that might lead you back down that same negative path. You have to have food. You have to have clothing. You have to have transportation because you don't want to miss much-needed probation appointments. But, you know, we know we need these things. We need hygienic products. We need these physical things. But I'm going to tell you, it has got to go further than that. We have got to be able to work with people to heal their emotional traumas, because getting out of a bad situation is the first step only. You're still left messed up.
Yeah.
So that is most necessary to deal with. We must do that.
And I'd like to just chime in, Melissa, with the Warrior Within Project. And Sandy, I owe so much to you too, Lawrence. Because y'all helped me get my voice heard, and that's kind of my point, because I love a man who was tortured in the Florida DOC for 10 years. I'm also a child of the DOC and spoke to my father through the glass window. I wasn't enough to touch my father in person when I was young at 5. I do fully believe, as far as, you know, what they do to y'all, and I also am an abuse survivor from childhood sexual, physical, and neglect. And I can only tell you that my empathy is what led me here, because my heart bleeds for the man I love, because you know what they did for 10 years is they broke his self-worth down. They tell you you're not enough for medical care, as in you don't get it for emergency. And I've seen it play out myself. 48 hours it took me to get him emergency care in the DOC, in his current situation, or he was lied on. But anyway, that's fruiting in a whole other way. What I have seen is every time, and I call the DOC the darkness, because it is dark in there with man's money and greed weighing on everybody. And they show you by action, and action speaks louder than words, they show you by action that you are not enough. And just like the gentleman spoke to, you know, you're put into a childlike state, not by choice of your own, but by rules, regulations. You can't just go to the emergency room. You have to fill out a form, and then you've got to wait for that process. You can't just go get food when you're hungry, as humans should be able to. You have to wait till chow, and then you've got, what, 12 hours between dinner and breakfast? And then you're fighting your bunkmate over some ramen noodles. It's tragic. We break you down. We as a society who allow this, cheek turners, we break you down. We do not build you up before you come out. And then we come out and we say, go at it with what we broke you down to. Because chances are you're coming out worse mentally. The things you all endure day in and day out. I heard the screams in the background on a call from the county jail. Somebody slapped losing their mind from the inside because we keep you from human touch. We keep you from light. I saw it on the jail windows. They're all tinted. We do it in the mental health system. We do it to our homeless and others. But I do believe that, you know, we have got to turn the light on for everybody to see what's going on in that darkness, because if we can build you, if we can break you down in there, we, with little money, can show you empowerment and self-worth and self-value and self-appreciation. And I believe that is one of the biggest answers in prison reform, is if we are breaking, first off, we have got to slow down on these people who think they can take law into their own hands, because y'all are going through cruel and unusual punishment, vile. And the outside doesn't know. The outside just turns cheek thinking the statistics on the front are what is true, and that's not true, because I know everyone behind bars is experiencing abuse beyond what their punishment is due, period. And I'll digress. I just had to share that. I believe self-empowerment, self-worth, and self-value is the way for our men and women behind bars to succeed when they come out. And I,
amen.
I've got
amen.
With Jamie. Yes, and Jamie, too. It's beautiful. It's fruiting, and I believe it will for everybody if we just break it down. Breathing exercises, meditation, being mindful, knowing that you're worth goodness, success, a home. Sometimes you're worth toasting the Pop-Tart instead of just eating it. Sometimes we got to break it down that basic. And that's where we can relate, because we have all felt not worthy at some point in our lives. And I'll cut off right there.
No, absolutely.
Thank you.
No, thank you. It's beautiful. Beautifully put. I mean, this is the whole thing about coming in one room and moving in one direction, is our voices being heard. And with that said, Jamie, I'd love to hear anything you got to say, your backstory, what you're doing.
Yes. Hi, my name is Jamie Quarion, and I spent 10 years in the Florida DOC from the age 17 to 27. And it's corrupt. Like, they present all these classes, but you're fighting every day, especially in the youthful offender camps. Like, they have fight night Fridays where you're forced to fight. There's drugs, there's tobacco, there's everything that you would obtain that there is on the street. You're not being – there's no change, there's no reform, there's no – rehabilitation, there's no correctness, there's no, the officers treat, like, I was beat up twice in handcuffs by the officers, and I watched this go on daily, especially in the mental health facilities. I always wondered why there's no light, why there's no light in these cells and the hallways, and it's dark and it's gloomy, and they want to tranquilize you and these inmates, and you end up worse off getting out into society, and it's a cycle. They tell you there's a bed waiting for you for your return. Inmate violence is horrendous. Faces are slashed with a razor blade. Like Florida DOC, they stand on the motto care, custody, and control. But there is none of that in the Florida DOC. My life was endangered every single day. I'm overly paranoid now. I'm messed up. And I'm struggling at living life because I didn't learn how to live life. I didn't have no guidance growing up. There's a lot of mistreatment and neglect and abandonment, child sexual abuse. I mean, I was even like, I'm all about being transparent now, and I believe that is the key to healing. And so, and I believe that others can be healed with words I speak too, in the sense that they can relate. But in the DOC, Florida Department of Corrections, I was sent to work release finally, and I was sent to a place where I didn't sign up that actually had the highest turnover rate in the Florida Department of Corrections. And I was set up, I was lied on, and I was taken back to prison. And the DR, I sat in confinement for 8 days, and the DR was dropped. No charges against me. I got sent back to the compound. Well, none of my grievances that I wrote even made it back to me. I sent grievances out saying that I'm not in trouble, that I should be allowed to go back to work release. Well, I assume they denied that. Well, while I was on the compound, I was attacked. I was beat up in the bathroom, and I was raped. And I didn't get no help. I told the officers, I told the white shirts, the lieutenants, and the lieutenant himself told me if I don't go back to, I was in handcuffs at this time. Because it almost happened again. Like, I didn't know how to go. Do I stab this guy? What do I do? So I ended up having to go to the chaplain. And the chaplain was the only one that heard my voice. He was the only one that helped me get out of that situation. And then I was taken to medical, and tests were taken. And I was put in confinement. And instead of transferring me, because now there's all this bad news about me on the compound, and the same inmate was being released too with me on the compound, on the same compound, we're still together. And because I had ran and got help, he put a $200 hit on me to get me off the compound. And now with that, that's enough. COC felt like that's enough now to get me off the compound. Well, what about when I was sexually abused and then I cried out for help? Mm-hmm. That's how corrupt the system is. And
so I have a question, Jamie.
And
I'm sorry to interrupt you. You there?
Yes.
Okay, I have a question. So you know how we always talk about the misconduct of cops, COs in the prison system? Was the $200 paid with? Was it television? Was it other people's property? Do you know the extent of what was paid?
In this case, it would be wire money. I would have to have my family either send money, or he was the guy that did this. He offered $200 wire money, meaning that he would have somebody on the outside, Western Union or whatever, Green Dot, whatever, the money to the person's commissary account, or to his family on the outside, uh-huh. or or whoever. But a lot of the stuff comes in from the officers. If money can be made off of it, the officers are bringing it in. From cell phones to weapons. And that's what's making the prison system violent.
Yeah, I wanted to bring it to light because a lot of times, you know, when I talk about it, a lot of people go, yeah, okay. But, I mean, there's so many of us speaking out against this now that it has to. There has to be some truth to it, you know? So I'm glad you're speaking out on it.
I've seen somebody get into a fight over toilet paper because somebody stole their toilet paper because you only get one toilet paper every 10 days. That could only last you so much. And because there's a lack of toilet paper, you get your toilet paper stolen. It's wild. Fighting over a ramen noodle soup, a 75-cent soup, people's faces are getting cut with razor blades, hit with locks and socks, bars of soap, getting jumped in the bathroom. It's people are getting physically hurt, like really hurt. I've seen a skull get caved in at nighttime with a lock inside of a sock, combination lock, a metal lock, caved his skull in. I've seen a broomstick. Like, I could get vile. Like, it's horrendous. At YO, at JIT camp, me starting off as a youthful offender, they have something called TOH, test of heart. When you get there, you're going to get tried. They're going to come in your room, and they're going to put you through a test to see if you're going to fight back for your commissary. If you don't, they know they're getting paid from you. They're getting your commissary. A broomstick.
Yeah.
I watched a broomstick get, shoved up the rectum and broke, and the guy went out to outside medical and it internally damaged him. There's the drugs is rampant. Get the K2. I've seen people die off this K2. It affected me. I was non-responsive for 8 minutes. And I didn't get adequate medical attention. I get put in confinement. I woke up, didn't know where I was. The guy is gunning. Sorry for the disrespect, but it's just being real. And he had his private area out, you know, and me and him end up into a fight. And because my PTSD and I had flashbacks. So they put me in, they finally moved me after causing me a whole bunch of trouble. They separated us and put me in a cell by myself. And then, like, 2-3 weeks later, they try to move me back to the same cell with the same guy, even though they keep separate, even though there's a red flag. This is when the officer slammed me on my face in handcuffs and basically hog-tied me. I was on my stomach, and the officer sat on my legs, bent back, like, my knees messed up. My collarbone's messed up. I broke my collarbone twice. And then they did nothing for me for medical. And because they did that, they I don't know. It's just, it's corrupt, and we need help. There's so many in there.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
There's so many in there that have stories that need to be heard, and that's my vision. That's my dream, because my heart, a part of it's left on the inside, because I know those boys and women are suffering, and It affects your everyday living. It affects your life. It affects coming out into the community, and life ain't what it used to be, or life ain't what you thought it was, and it's a real live struggle.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
Jamie,
and
may I thank you so much, Jamie, for sharing your story.
Thank you, Sandy.
I think it's necessary for change. I mean, we got to band together and start speaking out against the injustice and the issues that society thinks that we're going into these places and getting better, and they have no idea that they're being hoodwinked, you know, by their own government, saying that these people are going away to get better, but they don't understand the inside. And until we all come together and start speaking out of this, it's not going to get addressed, you know. So I really do, like Sandy said, I appreciate you coming on and speaking your experience, and I just hope that we're able to empower you to, you know, and help and assist you to do with something with that, you know, to help make changes and at least bring awareness and give people their voice back. I think that's very important. So,
if I may, reiterate a little bit from legacy programs. I'm Brady. I'm Lawrence's younger brother. Childhood experiences. I won't get into it. It's not my time. But Jamie, you know, you guys are, relation to your guys' stories that you guys are putting on here. You know, it really takes a special individual to go through those life crises. You know, inside the prisons, you get put through the tests, like you said. You get put through obstacles of scenarios that are just horrendous. But what I'm trying to get at is the people out here that are listening, the ones that are out there and they're free and that have a loved one, you know, incarcerated, you have a loved one that's, you know, maybe not a loved one, just somebody that's out there that has a heart. You got to make phone calls. You got to make calls to the courts. You got to call. You're going to get the wrong answer from the deputy that's sitting behind the desk. Your tax dollars are at work. They work for you. Remember that. The people behind those bars of officers and whatever they want to call themselves, correctional personnels or even the court systems, they work for you. They are a public servant. When an officer comes up to you and asks you a question and you're just out of the blue walking down the street, let me advise you of something. You have two options. You can stay quiet or you can use your brain and pick their brain right back. But it's up to you to use your words of intelligence. Make those phone calls for those people that are locked up, that are incarcerated. Call the courts. Call the, you know, when's their next court hearing? When is their next this? And they give you a broad answer that's just, you know, just a Mickey Mouse question mark. You got to ask again and keep asking and keep pushing. Yep. Don't stop, because the moment you stop, you can give them all control. They're getting paid whether your voice is heard or not. But your voice is only going to be heard at people if you call and you keep calling and you keep asking questions and you keep sending letters and you keep writing and you keep on them and you keep on them and you keep calling. Let me tell you, I know a certain individual that would call and call and call and call. I swear to God, they would call until they're blue in the face. And Lawrence probably knows who I'm talking about, but let me tell you, you know, it just amazes me. It amazes me with these stories that you guys have. Like, it's overwhelming. When is it going to be you have the remote in your hand? You have the control. Everybody wants to help. Everybody says they're going to do something. Everyone says, I want to get on board. I want to put my hands and feet in the water, and I want to swim. Well, guess what? Not everybody can be a chief. You have got to be an Indian before you're a chief. We have too many chiefs and not enough Indians. You got to make them phone calls and continue to make those phone calls and continue to get answers and continue to have your questions over and over until you're actually got the right information. Because let me tell you, when I was locked up, my wife never stopped calling. She never, when she sat outside the jail, they told him I would be released. Doesn't mean that's facts. They said, oh, 15 minutes. What'd she do? Went right back in after 15 minutes. You keep pushing. You don't give up. The moment you raise your hands and you walk away, all bets are off the table. You have full control over these people. And let me tell you, voice will be heard. Your voice can be heard.
I've got to say something, and I respect your brother very much, Lawrence, and very much. I think you're right.
I'm going back on
mute. We don't – hello?
Go ahead. I'm on mute. Go ahead.
Okay, no, I agree with you 100%. We absolutely cannot give up on people who are incarcerated. But, you know, something that I found very, very disconcerting was a letter I received yesterday from a mother that has a son that has been incarcerated for 20 years. She sent me a copy of the letter he wrote to her, and he said, "Mom, because you keep calling, I now have been retaliated against."
Mm-hmm.
His teeth were knocked out. His eye was blackened. His ribs were hurt. He was put in the SHU simply because his mother kept reaching out to say, "Can you give me information about my son?" So I 100% agree. We absolutely 100% cannot give up on these people, but we have to be very wise about how we do it. That's really all I had to say. And I thank you for the other things you said, because I 100% agree.
Strategic is everything. Being strategic, being classy like that they are inside the prisons, not even in the prisons. But you have to be classy. You have to be wise. You have to have a voice that's going to be heard, not just heard, but it's also going to make change. Now, that person that put harm on that personnel, you better start calling some more and getting names of that officer. That doesn't stop. It just makes a notation.
Well,
You can't just call people. You have to have facts. You have to have hard, strategic moves that you're going to make. It's not a game. It's someone's life on the line. Like she was saying that, people are going to get hurt and get retaliated against over these, certain issues. But there's, you got
to
show up.
Can I say something on that? Can I respond to that real quickly? First of all, I think our political leaders, I really blame them for all the things that have gone on with these people being so abused in these prisons. Because our legislative members, whether they want these people in prison or not, should be monitoring, should be overseeing what's going on in these prisons. I'm listening to all this abuse that's been going on. The media doesn't report it. Hell with the media. They need to stop being so biased and start reporting the issues that go on with these people incarcerated rather than the birds and the bees that they talk about.
Amen.
This is serious stuff. And these politicians need to get off their behinds, and they need to do something about this. What should have happened, Sandy, you mentioned this woman calling about her son.
Yes.
What she should have been able to contact the politicians and let them know, and they, in turn, did not need to mention the prisoner's name. They should have contacted them to find out, let them know they heard about these things that are going on, and that they want to go in and they want to start meeting with some of the prisoners and make her son one of them, the first one, the primary one, without getting him in trouble. But these political leaders are so busy trying to impress their peers and trying to be out in the limelight, just like a lot of these lawyers, these law firms, they want to be out in the media. They want their faces to be seen so people can say, oh, they got a good organization. Hell with the organization, because their faces are out there, their names are out there, but the prisoners are still without help. And Prisoner Legal Services in Massachusetts is one of them. The prisoners, when they call Prisoner Legal Services, they get the receptionist every time. But these people from Prisoner Legal Services, these lawyers, getting paid by the hour, are joining all these coalitions, are out in the media, getting their faces known and their titles known, while the prisoners are suffering. This goes on with a lot of people out there. And we as a society, members of society, need to stop making calls to these politicians, need to stop making calls to the media. But so many people are out there talking about what they should do and not doing it. And all these advocates on Facebook that are liking everything that they see or read or hear are doing absolutely nothing. Because if they were doing anything, they would persuade all these mothers, all these relatives, all these friends, all these advocates, all these people to stop making these calls. And I have to say this because I am a mother that's going through something really serious right now. My son's locked physically, spiritually, psychologically in a cage 22 hours a day, 2 hours out. A four-year biology major tells them when they perform surgery after 2 years of letting him suffer not to remove the cartilage
in his shoulder.
What do they do? They removed it anyway after they put him under. Now he can't exercise. He can't do anything. He's like a cripple.
Oh, no.
These people are nothing but no good, barbaric people. And any politician that sits back and allows these things to happen, they're just as evil, just as bad. And I know, there's no doubt about it, that they are also going to be going through the same thing. Their families are going to be in anguish because God does not like evil. And no doubt God is going to be holding them accountable for sitting back in their chairs, talking to their peers, and ignoring all these things that are being talked about on this show today. A man gets paid. Don't you know what?
And if you look at every presidential race, whoever is running is going to say, we are going to cut back on crime. These people will be punished.
Talk.
Yeah. You know, what's crazy is that when it's the inmate life, when we're going through this abuse, nobody cares. And, you know, the politicians don't care. And this is a common theme. This isn't just one or two people. This has turned into a standard. But, yet, you know, when they want to talk, they're tough, but they do nothing against the doctors for their abuse. They do nothing against the, you know, when you see all these things. I mean, I could commit one crime and a police officer could commit the same crime, and I'm going away 20 years. But yet that police officer is going to get probably 6 months to blast me all over the news. They'll keep him secret. And I think that's the double standard that, you know, it is today. But, you know, it's a shame of how our population and how our people are being treated behind those walls due to a crime. But no one's looking at when the crime was committed, the community, society failed us. We did not fail the society, the community ourselves. We had the tools that we thought were necessary. We were put wrong, that's fine. But, you know, none of us were condemned to death in behind those walls. We were condemned to a certain time. And we're not supposed to be dehumanized. That's why incarceration is not the answer anymore. It has to be really rehabilitative communities. It has to be through therapy. It has to be through cognitive behavior thinking and connecting the dots, going back to childhood trauma. And, you know, I just think that the people of today have lost touch. And they're so busy wagging the finger at other people and hiding their own, you know, discrepancies that it's just easy to blame everybody else. But the thing is that just because they commit the crime does not mean they're not human beings.
Is it my phone? I'm hearing you cutting out in and out.
I mean,
it may be my phone.
No,
I hear that too.
I hear the same thing. Can I interject here for a second? This is Anthony.
Yes, sir.
Oh, so I'm going to go to the point of what this initial discussion derived from, which was what are the solutions. And I don't think that there needs to be a critical analysis on what the actual problem is first before we can even get to the solution. Right
the
now,
zone of emotional development.
Huh? Oh,
I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to chime in. It's the zone of emotional development that we need to figure on the before prison and then once prior to release, because your zone of emotional development is how when you come out, like you said, remember you brought it down to like it brings you to a childlike behavior, well, or mindset. So if we actually find, and we can now, there's calculations and observations through study where we can identify your zone of emotional development before you come out of there. And we've got to know that your zone of emotional development has got to be a certain level for you to succeed in society. And I just, that's a little piece on that. I apologize. Go ahead.
No, I'm going to expound on, well, initially I was going to come with a different perspective, but let's start with that, what you just said. This goes right to the heart of the matter. You keep referring to, I'm not trying to direct this at you. I'm just going off the statement you just made, which supports my narrative, which is that everyone keeps coming from a book perspective. You're coming from a theological and theory perspective. And those perspectives, although qualified by case studies and empirical studies, you have to look at the nuances that go on in a prison setting when you're actually there as a person, as being the subject. And those things can't be spoken to because of your profession, because you're not an actual prisoner. You're just going off what the prisoner is telling you and what the book says supposed to happen with the prisoner. So I understand what you're saying when you're talking about what was the term you used? Emotional what?
It's called the zone of emotional development.
Okay.
It's more for us to, you know, have the prisoners tell us exactly what they need. That's exactly what I was saying.
But the prisoner is only telling you this, right, because of what he's experiencing. And it is being placed as a general statement for all prisoners. And all prisoners are not going through the same thing. Me, for instance, and I'm not trying to take away from anything that the other guests have been through. My form of a childhood abuse was not sexual. Mine was more physical, beatings and punishment. So I don't want to sit here and blast the person who did it, but we're talking about what type of anger and resentment stemmed from that, and then how did I deal with those things later on in life. Now, what I want to go to, because that's what's at heart right now, is looking at the solutions. But you guys begin to speak on something very beautiful, and we're not going into the heart of that matter. Let's look at the cost analysis for each prisoner, and I will break down to you what's going on behind the scene. Theoretically, they say, in general, each prisoner costs per year $33,000. Is that a fair assessment?
I believe it's up to $100,000 in California.
Well, let's just take the lower number. You got each institution. You have 33 prisons in California. The feds have a whole lot more, but let's just go for one. It's costing them allegedly $33,000 per prisoner, right? $33,000 to house a prisoner per year. And each yard, some of the yards I've been on, there are 1,200 prisoners on each quadrant of a yard. So the yard that I was on in California State Prison, they have four of these. So 1,200 times four is 4,800, right? 4,800 people times 33,000. Now, listen to the logistics. When I go, now, as an inductee or somebody who's coming fresh in off the prison, I mean off the bus from county jail, they're going to give me one set of T-shirts, one set of socks, one set of boxers, some elastic weight bands pants, and a very thin blue CDCR shirt. You're going to give me three of those. I'm going to get three of these. All of these clothes are made by what they call the PIA, or Prison Industry Authority. This is an internal workforce that are ran by the prisons as a subsidiary of the California Department of Corrections, but all the people in there are inmates that are sewing all these clothes. So they're buying this from their self off the $33,000 that you gave them. That's that. You get that set of clothing once a year. You get that once a year. Now, when you're talking about meals, right? The meals, they have it already in public view. It costs a dollar or less than a dollar a day to feed us, because we're getting fed the worst of things that they can possibly find. Everything they get is either donated as a tax write-off from all the agricultural developers, or something that they're buying at way below market because it's already near expiration. So then you get the housing aspect. Those buildings have been there since they've been built. So the amortization aspect of it is long gone. It's been paid for itself a long time ago, a very long time ago, and it's owned by the state. The next thing you have to do is safety and security. Well, the correctional officers have a set salary. So you have one correctional officer that is monitoring no less than 300 people per officer. That's why it's always talking about the shortage of staff, because it's only two or three staff watching, then there's 600 inmates. Then you have the lieutenants and the yard officers or the compound officers, which is only a handful, and they're sitting in the office all day long until a fight happens. That's the only time they come out. And the other officers, he's sitting down at a desk all day long because the inmates are running around back and forth. That's why so many things happen. So there is no real sense of urgency to watch these inmates to justify the cost of $33,000 per inmate times 4,800. So this is where...
Hey, Anthony.
Yes.
And I got a question. Who runs the prisons? Who monitors, who keeps the population in check?
I thank you for that. I almost forgot that part. So yeah, that's what he was talking about, what you guys want to talk about. Okay, so the prison, thank you for bringing that up. The prison has what they call a Title 15 in California Department of Corrections, and in the feds is called the BOP Program Statement. So this is how it's supposed to run, according to these policies and the courts of these administrative rules and directives and orders. And this is what the officers tell you that you should be going by. But once you get on a yard, the prisoners themselves, we've fashioned, and I say we because I was a part of this populace, we fashioned what we call yard politics. These are things of how you're going to do things. When you're black, you're going to be with blacks in your race. When you're white, you're going to be with whites in your race. When you're Mexicans, you're going to be white Mexicans in your race. And there are subsets inside of that because, one, you've been a Bay Area. Somebody else can be from Los Angeles. Somebody else can be from Central California. Over here in the Mexicans, somebody can be a Serrano. Somebody can be a Norteño. Somebody can be a Paisa. And the whites, you got white supremacists, Aryan Brotherhood, white boys. It depends. But the reason for that is because when something happens and you need to be checked about some behavior you demonstrated, you need to be checked by your own race. Because once it goes interracial confrontation, everybody has to go. Everybody has to get involved in that. So those are protective measures done or put in place to mitigate against a more broader disruption. That's why. If you go talk to the police, you're going to bring two people with you. The reason why that's been put in place is because you need to have witnesses of what was said so you can't be termed a snitch or somebody who was actually going to be friends with the police trying to, you know, get a little extra on the side or trying to deal with the police like that. So those are protective measures that are put in place. Commissary. When you go to commissary, and I can't speak for the other guy, but I don't know what his experiences was, but when you go to commissary, you know, 9 times out of 10, you're getting these funds from your family and relatives. And commissary is put there in place because the food that they're giving you is worth nothing. But now you go to the commissary, and that's worth nothing. It's nothing on there but sweets,
beans,
top
rice,
noodles,
sausage,
packages of fish, baked fish. I'm talking about clams that are in packages with preserved in cottonseed oil and salt and mackerels, pink salmon. This all this stuff is just the worst of the worst. And top ramen noodles, candy. Nothing nutritional is about commissary, but the thing is that this is what they give you in substitution to compensate for the nutritional values that you're missing that they're supposed to give you with that $33,000. And you're going to spend, and the key part of this is the only people paying for this is the families and the relatives that are feeding the prison system because those proceeds are technically supposed to go to the inmate welfare fund. This because they're not supposed to make a profit off of the commissary. But when they put the contracts out, they're only putting the contracts to certain companies who have an interest in the penal system, who are the politicians who own it, just like O'Keefe or just like Keefe Coffee. George Bush owns that.
Yeah.
George Bush owns that.
How about Walkenhurst catalog? The catalogs, they're all owned by former COs.
Go to Access Packages or Union Supply Packages or go look up commissary items and look at the stuff that they're giving. And they're one soup in prison costs you 30 cents or 35 cents. One top ramen soup in the county jail costs you $1.05. There's something wrong with that.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with that.
That's right.
There is. How about the toothpaste that we buy in there for $5 and out here?
Yeah,
only
exactly.
$5.
The Colgate
or the
toothpaste.
Soaps. You could buy a whole pack. You could buy a whole pack of soap out here for the price you buy one.
Yeah.
Or the medical they charge your commissary for.
Yeah.
I
would
Anthony brings
to
up
you, Anthony, if you would like to hear it. I have interviewed over 40 people nationwide in the book that I'm in the process of writing to expose our system. And one of them actually sent me a picture a few days ago of the hygienic products that he received while incarcerated. You talk about minimal. I don't know how you could wash your body more than one time with the picture of the bar of soap that this gentleman sent me. It's disgusting. I've heard of food from another person I interviewed that had maggots in it and green beans that had worms. I have not been incarcerated, but because of my advocacy work and because of the interviews I've done for my book, I do actually have a pretty good view of what's going in there. I mean, you know, I either speak with or correspond with inmates across the nation on a daily basis. I would love to join forces with you because what you are saying, along with what I already know about Lawrence Jamie and, oh my gosh, you know, there's so much that needs to be exposed, so much.
Yeah. Well, we're doing it right now, and let's not talk about what we're talking about, just to shift the narrative to the next stage. So I went to the feds, and when you go through a trial process, because we're talking about the legal remedies here for an individual who has to fight their own case. Because of Bill Clinton and the AEDPA Act, the Anti-Effect Death Penalty Act, they only gave you one time to file what they call a post-conviction remedy in the federal system. And you got one shot, and you got 1 year to figure it out on how you're going to place a competent motion in front of a United States District Court to challenge the validity of your conviction. We're talking about somebody who never went to law school, right? But they got you going up against a trained, vicious prosecutor, an assistant United States attorney, and you have to place a issue. You have to find the standard of review. You have to find the actual cause and means to give the court jurisdiction to even hear the claim. All of these things as a pro se litigant, which I did. But what I'm saying is the average person is going to become flustered. He's going to become angry, confused, frustrated, because he doesn't even understand the legalese, the legal terminology.
That's right.
Anthony.
I have five cases right now that I'm going through. And I really wish Melissa Everling lived a little closer because I know she would be supportive. What I do is I research these cases. If I find that the case has not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, I send them to organizations that can further help these individuals.
But that's I'm sorry to cut you off. I'm sorry, but that's a very elusive concept, because it doesn't have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, because that's the standard for a trial. But when the court goes to impose the sentence in the feds, they can use another standard called relevant conduct, and all they have to do is prove by preponderance of evidence.
Yep.
Oh, well, I would love to learn more about that. Absolutely.
Hey, Anthony.
I'm open to learning everything I can.
Yeah,
I was going to ask you, how many years, because I know this, but how many years does it take for the average inmate to learn about law in prison?
It took me 9. And I'm going to tell you why I say nine, because I did nine. Every time you go through a different court or a different motion, that's a practice. That's why they call it a legal practice, because it's a science, but it's not an exact science. All right? So how you approach the court in the district court is vastly different how you're going to approach the appellate court. And how you approach the appellate court is vastly different how you're going to approach the Supreme Court. And in those courts, there are different what they call motions. A motion is a means to move the court in any direction, right? Because you're petitioning the court to move at your will. So when you file a motion, right, you have to file the motion, the jurisdictional claim, the standard of review. Without filing the standard of review, that can be fatal to your motion because you're not giving the court a clear understanding on what it is that you're asking for. What is your claim?
Yeah.
What is your issue? What is the law on this? You see, there's a simple principle called an Iraq principle, issue, rule, argument, and conclusion. You lay out the issue, what's the rule, what's your argument, and then what's the conclusion. But you're talking about somebody who doesn't know the law or the relevant law because the law that they're giving you is not currently up to date because you don't have access to PACER or the current landscape of the judicial system at that time. You're a pro se litigant.
Yeah, and how many people miss out on their court dates and their deadlines because of the mail that's being tampered with, the process,
They have this thing called a mailbox rule that if the motion is dated, right, I'm going to say, whoa, you're hitting some good points. If it's dated correctly, however, if the most institutions do not have the registration forms or the logbook to show that you actually filed this on time. If you go through and do an audit on all the BOP institutions, majority of them do not have a mass majority, the overwhelming majority, do not have a logbook to determine whether or not, well, that kind of works for the inmate too, because it's like, hey, they don't have a record, but I put it in. But technically,
you go on lockdown for safety security, you got to make it to the law library, you have to have PLU.
So many people have lost their life because of unforeseen circumstances, and you've missed a court date, and you've missed the opportunity to address your claim. So once that happens, they want to take it to another standard called, it's not on the back of my mind, but they're going to ask what's the reason. It's something more clear than that. But they want to know what the reason is. And if that reason is not justifiable according to law, then you lost out on your claim.
Yeah. Well, the reason why I asked you that question was because it took me about 15 years to understand anything about law.
Right.
I was so busy with the politics. I didn't have time to go to law library. And a lot of times my people wouldn't even allow me to go to law library to do research.
Right.
And not only that is they only allow 6 to 7 people if you're at a good facility with the computers and the resources. But the resources are all also they're not up to date. They give you the they're about 5 years behind at all times. And the reason why I say that is because within that 1 year, within that 1 year, a lot of times you don't know anything about law. And a lot of people that have these messed up cases with factors that they don't want to put out there in the public.
Yeah.
They're so ashamed of them that they can't fight that properly because they can't, they have to trust somebody. They have to go talk. And if out, it's life threatening. So, I mean, what do you talk about when there's a mitigating something that can be damaging to your safety and security, you know?
That's absolutely right. So I believe what you're talking about are sex offenders. And I understand, okay, so in that case, you're absolutely right, because you don't know what the circumstances were, even though they may be questionable as to how you even got involved in that situation. Every time it's only being viewed from the victim's perspective, but I know full well in court, there's two sides to every story. And a lot of people, you know, want to place blame on the individual, but you don't know what are all the contributing factors. And a true indeed when a person gets incarcerated with those type of crimes, because of the inmate politics, we're going to ask to see your paperwork. We're going to need to see what you're in here for, whether or not you're telling, because you're around nothing but the worst. You, when you're in prison, you're not around a bunch of good guys. These are everybody who was cutting class, smoking weed, stealing cars, robbing people, doing everything under the sun. And so these all
But there's also... But no, but there's a hierarchy too. The hierarchy of crime in prison that we don't talk about. The murderers on top, the gang members next to them, the sex offenders all the way at the bottom.
Yeah, well, okay, the reason why that is because people need somebody to blame. People need somebody to vent and to make all their problems become their problems. You know, you know, it's because society has allowed for the permission or the license to turn the other cheek when it comes to sex offenders, because it becomes such a heinous crime, allegedly, by the politicians who are committing these same crimes and then getting slaps on the wrist for it. But that's another story. But at the same time, it's because of what they, like the young lady said, it's the politicians who are getting out here with this, I'm going to take, oh no, the guy said it. It's the, I'm going to get a tough on crime approach, and you do all these rallying points. And you allow the officers who are in charge of custody and control of these same individuals to allow the inmates to deal with them in a manner, whichever way that they see fit. So going to your point, these guys are scared to fight their case because everything becomes public record once you become an adult. And so nobody wants, and so everything that you do, by policy, they have to give you your paperwork. They have to give you what you're in here for, no matter if you're a sex offender or not. And everybody knows this. So all they have to do, because like during the classification process in the state, you're going to go in and you're going to have somebody there waiting on the outside with you. They're going to classify you and they're going to give you that long sheet of paper that shows what your term is, what your out date is, what you're in here for, and what's your criminal history. And what is your classification?
Yep.
If you got this thing called an R suffix on your jacket, on that piece of paper, that means you've been either convicted of a sex crime or you have sexual convictions in your history. That's an automatic stabbing. Yep. That's an automatic stabbing. And nobody's going to wait around for a CO to leave, for somebody to go into the office and wait. No. Once they see that R, you out of here. They finna handle you right there. I don't care who you are, black, white, Mexican, you got a green light from everybody to get you off the rip. And the feds is pretty much the same thing. When you go over there and you get your computation sheet and you get your paperwork, they need to see that as soon as you hit the door. Everybody going, hey, you know what I'm saying? What's up, bro? How you doing? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, where you from? Okay, look, we need to see your paperwork. Period. Ain't nobody want to talk to you or nothing until they see that work. Once we get that work, everything else will open up. But we need to know who you are, where you from, and what you about. We need to see that work. So that's why these guys are really in a bad situation.
Yeah. And I just love your perspective. And I just appreciate, you know, if we need more of us to come out and just speak about this stuff, because unless we can't, you know, we can't address it and we can't find solutions. Before we go into anything else, I'd like to ask Leona if there's anybody else on the line that has any questions or comments. Okay. And then I do want to introduce
what resources are there to take upon something like that? Because that's an ongoing, you know, that's a severity. Well, you're talking about you getting stabbed right when you get in. I mean, people are dying out. That's unreal.
That's real.
Unreal.
No, that's what's real. I'm not trying to make
No, you painted a good picture, man. You're very knowledgeable, and I hope you get into criminal law in some way or criminal justice in some manner, but.
Thank you.
What you're sharing is is heart-touching. And I mean, what are the resources? Well, we're hearing the stories, but we're not hearing how, like you said, you got to get it to the beta, you know, of the root cause in order to get to the – try to fix it. But,
well, and that's why we talk about a broken system. You know, this is a messed up system that we're meant to fail before we even start.
Yes, let's look at this.
It failed us way back as children. It failed us all way back as children.
I think something very important for you to point out right now, Lawrence, is the nonprofit you're working toward. Because that really encompasses all the help that we can give. Everything from having a place to live when you get outside to working with those who are incarcerated through cognitive behavioral therapy. And, you know, I'm going to say this. We are not what we have done in our past. We are not what people have told us we are, and we are not how people see us. When we learn how to genuinely, authentically accept ourselves, that's when we strive. That's when we blow up. That's when we make a difference for others. And Lawrence, your organization, Legacy Programs, Education and Reentry, my gosh, you've got every bit of that in there. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the whole thing about Legacy Programs, Education Reentry is, and if anyone wants to find out more, you can find us on legacyprograms.net. You know, I've been part of the system since 9 years old. I know I have ideas what needs to be fixed. I'm not driven by fear to shut up and shut my mouth. I'm very outspoken. And,
yeah.
I mean, the system can't hurt me any more than what it's done. So we work on getting the community involved in the support network necessary for the person incarcerated. Not only do we take, is it a year program after you get out, but we also go in while you're incarcerated and give you the tools and build the network for you by the time you get out. Because, you know, reentering back into society, it takes a village. It takes many of us. And that's why our mentors we're hybrid. You know, we're being trained as life coaches as well, because I believe in order to succeed, you have to have the best teacher is the person that's been inside. And also with the education of out here and how to communicate and how to deal with these issues. And people like Anthony is going to be – he's an asset. You know, he's going to be able to give all perspective.
Anthony is a major asset. Major asset.
I mean,
thank you, guys.
I'm very fortunate to be working with him and his knowledge and how raw he is. And I love having people part of the – you know, we all play a different role. We all fit a different piece of the puzzle, and that's why – you know, we're going to be successful in what we do. Right now, what we need to work on is getting a lawyer for misconduct within the prisons. That's what my next project besides the transitional housing. I want a lawyer in every state to investigate all the misconduct and be able to take this pro bono and to actually and go after this powerful union, because there's too many. I was beaten up by the Green Wall in Salinas Valley back in early 2000. And, you know, that was after the Thanksgiving situation. And, you know, these are the things passionate to me and like Anthony, what we've been through. And we need a lawyer. If there's any lawyers out there that want to take a case in a different state, we need one in Massachusetts right now, that we need to investigate how these COs are beating up these inmates at these facilities and getting away with it. Because if I go out and beat somebody in public, there's no way I'm getting away with it. But yet these COs are, because they have the license to kill, to hurt, and to harm. And they're supposed to be the ones rehabilitating us. And that's the misconception that society has, that these places are meant to fix us. They're meant to dehumanize us, to break us down, and to build us up, not to get better, but to come back.
You know,
they always say, we'll leave the light on for you. That is why the system, and why it's important.
There's no hope. I mean, recidivism rates in the United States are absolutely astounding. And that is because
we allow
there are no organizations
There is very little correspondence. You know, I hear from one person who's been incarcerated, and he says, I'm going through every program I can. I speak with another person, and he says, I don't get any opportunities for programming.
Right. Well, because the people, there's a scan. There's a screening process, and they put in, and a lot of these screening processes are sheriff's departments. So if the sheriff's department, if you have a history in that county, you got nothing coming. They want to see you go back. When I was released, they released me homeless. Yeah. So the high level, think of me, for instance, 20 years in prison. Last time I was out, I was 16 years old. And so, and then all of a sudden I come out, I'm almost 40 years old, and I have no resources. They don't want to help me. They want to, and that's why I came where I'm at today, because I got frustrated, but I was no longer going to be a victim. I was no longer going to live up to their standards and their title. I sat there and created a title of my own, which is of organization that we sit there and we are going to fight the system. We're not letting them get away with it. We're not going to shut our mouths. We're not going to stop our steps going forward. We are going to fight this full force. And that's the difference, is that these organizations that are getting money, they're padding their pockets, and they're offering no resources whatsoever. None. So now it's become they've become just as criminal as the people as they're supposed to help. And this is the problem I have with the ACLU, with all these different movements. They talk about what they're doing for people, but yet they're not doing anything to help us. And yet our people are still suffering behind those walls. The coronavirus is on its fourth string of mutation because they handled it falsely, but yet they get away with it because they're CDCR or because they're DOC or BOP. And it's to me, and excuse my language, but it's bullshit. And the time is now where we're going to sit here. I'm raising a freaking army, and we're going to attack this because I'm tired of everyone talking about what they're going to do and doing nothing. And their actions are not matching up with their words or their mission statements, but yet their account is getting fatter by the year and by the month. And it's on the backs of our people, our family, and our communities that they are completely out of touch with what needs to be fixed. So,
can I ask
I sit here and
just a quick question. Is Massachusetts the only one that has prisoners in their cells 22 hours a day?
No. It's nationwide.
Everywhere.
It is nationwide. Yeah. It's nationwide.
And not only that, but if you go on COVID quarantine here in Virginia, and I imagine it's everywhere, you start off 14-day quarantine.
Yes.
If you leave for the emergency room, Jamie did a few times, he ended up 42 of 46 days on quarantine, 23 and a half hours lockdown for the COVID.
I was quarantined for 6 months.
You telling the truth?
They took all our bedding, all our stuff. They put it outside. They took our televisions. They took our clothing. They took our food. They put them outside the building. They sprayed it with God knows what.
True.
And then they put us in a barrack in CRC with no bedding. We were lucky. We had to take the sheets out of the laundry, wash them, and to use them. And it's cold as hell at night over there.
Yes.
So let me tell you how they're handling this. They got extra funding for every COVID case. But what they did was they infected all of us. They sent one person that was sick, five people that were sick, into a 100-man dorm, got everybody sick, and moved us around like cattle. So this is a conversation that pisses me off because they're still going through that. They're still taking people. You're being punished for catching COVID. And let me tell you something, if you don't catch COVID, you're being punished even more because until you catch it, you have no visits.
Right.
You have no your canteen is limited. You can't leave your cell. So tell me how being safe, washing your hands, like they told me, I couldn't go back to work as a plant ops until I caught COVID. They kept me quarantined. They kept testing me every 2 weeks until I tested.
Well,
but then when I did finally test.
They're keeping prisoners in 22-hour lockdown without even having any COVID-19. They're not allowing some of them to have any of their properties, television or otherwise. Their legal documents.
No.
But Let me tell you something, please.
They're promoting us to get sick.
That's because of
they want us to, because they get the funding.
Well, I don't have faith in the COVID-19
I'll tell you right there.
Shots. I simply don't. I don't have faith in those.
Me either.
Because
you know what's
they
crazy?
Have not been proven yet. They have not been proven to be effective.
And the thing is, the screening process is a joke. The cops come in, they ask five questions, they answer them, they check their temperature, and they let them go through. But let me tell you how many COs went in there sick. And not only that is a CO is allowed to go in a quarantine dorm.
That's the only way that we
Yes. But this is what happens is a CO goes into a quarantine dorm, comes out, and then goes into a non-quarantine dorm. They're not even quarantining themselves, and the COs don't wear masks.
That's right.
Because they say it's a joke. So let's just be honest here about – but they're bringing this – and then they cry. The COs cry about it when they bring it home to their families and their communities.
You're the one brought
So how do we – how do we raise hell?
This is the thing. I called the COs.
Perfume. Have you ever had a mask on, and have you ever smelled perfume?
No.
Or have you ever had a mask on and have smelled a fart? That's getting through your mask. So you better damn well know that the virus is not being stopped by wearing a mask.
Thank you.
No. No, and the vaccine is a joke, I believe myself, but – this is the thing is I called the prison about how they were handling it. Cause I'm still in contact with about 13 inmates, that call me on a regular basis and they tell me what's going on. So when I called the prison and asked them how they're handling COVID-19, they could not tell me anything that was trying to help. They did not have a plan. They were running in circles themselves. And when I asked them, I said, well, why are you taking, and I asked him, I said, why are you taking the property of these people? Why are you taking this man's television where he has to spend 22 hours in the cell? How is this productive? And they did not want to, they did not respond to me. Then when I reached out to the media, no one responded back. It's like I was shunned. And that pissed me off. I talked to the New York Times, Santa Maria Times. I left messages and nobody wanted to hear about the COVID inside the prison system. And everyone I called the ombudsman. The ombudsman is for us. It's for the family and the community. It's the communication line.
Supposed to be.
And they
supposed to be.
Yeah, well, no, he laughed at me. He told me not to call back no more. And this is from Mill Creek State Prison. Prison, CRC, I contacted them. They laughed at me.
Let's look at this for a second. This is I connected some dots. I spoke about this on one of my posts.
Okay, is this Anthony?
Yes.
Okay, yes.
You got pharmaceutical companies who were held accountable by the United States government for contributing to the opioid crisis about 2018, 2019. This is correct? Okay.
Yes.
The coronavirus comes, so they had to fork up billions of dollars. All these companies got sued for billions of dollars. 2020, right? Donald Trump gives $2 billion to the same pharmaceutical companies that they already owe the United States government to develop a vaccine, right? Now, all these pharmaceutical companies, the same ones that got prosecuted by the United States government, are lining up to cash off of the coronavirus vaccine. The government gives us $3 trillion in funds from the United States to the tune of $3,200 for the majority of people in the United States. But guess what? The efficacy of these vaccines lasts 6 months. Each one after this first one costs the American public between $300 to $400. $400 times two is $800 because you're going to need it twice a year now. For the next 4 years, it's $3,200. So the only people who are benefiting are the same pharmaceutical companies.
Sandy, please, I wanted to say we have about five more minutes, and Lawrence, if you want to wrap it up and let everyone know to maybe pick up on it next Sunday or however you want to do it. But we have 5 minutes.
I love this conversation we're having, and I wanted to give Star a couple minutes to say what she needed to say. She hasn't had a chance. Anything you want to add, Star?
Yeah, I wanted to say that and I'm listening to everybody on here and all their concerns and everything that they've gone through within that system. And I always, you know, it's the teacher in me. I like to make sure people are educated about why the conditions are the way that they are. And this stuff stems all the way back to 1865. So when a people were going to be free, the government, the people on the land were trying to figure out, how are we going to keep these people slaves? Okay, well, we know how we'll do it. We'll give them that 13th Amendment, and with that, we'll make sure there's a loophole in there.
That's what I was going to say.
Trying to purge people up, because we need to get them back on this plantation, back into the prisons, back into whatever systems we create to keep them slaves. So people are wondering, why are the conditions bad? Because legally, you are property. You are a slave.
Yes.
And until we figure that out, and you're begging them, help me, help me, help me. You begging a bunch of demons.
Yeah.
All you're begging. Amen. You're begging a bunch of demonic people feeding a beast system to help you.
Yes.
Yes. And I want to sit there and invite everybody that's on today and anybody else that wants to join in the conversation for next week. We have a few minutes. Star, I want you to give your info. Sandy, Anthony, I want everybody to take at least a minute to give what you got to say. You can reach me on legacyprograms.net. I'm also on LinkedIn and Facebook under Sparky Lee Legacy Programs. Star, would you like to give your info?
You guys can find me at PowerPanel365. You guys can just Google me. You can find us on Facebook, and all of our contact information is there. And I know I didn't get much time, but we do a number of things. We try to reach out to our community, reach out to those in prison, you know, out of prison, you name it, we do it. And especially educating people on why some of these things are happening. And you guys, if you guys are saying you guys are going to try to get at people and form groups and stuff like that, you guys are going to have to literally start at the top. You're going to have to make so much noise. It's going to have to be very militant. You're not going to be asking the police anymore. Okay, well, do you guys write the checks? Okay, we don't need to talk to you then. We need to talk to the people that make the financial decisions. And you're going to have to start with your mayor, the senators, all those people that are in office. Those are the people that you guys need to be talking to. Those lower level
people
that are on
the stuff that Leona's been talking about.
All you have to do is look at them as slave overseers, because that's all they are.
Yeah, absolutely. I apologize. This is the first time I've had this many people on, so I apologize for not next week. I will make sure you're on and you get to tell everything you're doing. That was my intention. I apologize.
All right.
Anybody else want to sit there and give your contacts?
Yeah, you can find me, Anthony McGee, as MCGEE. I'm out of Oakland. You can find me on Facebook, and currently I have an email for amcgee70@yahoo.com.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate your input. And Sandy? Sandy, are you on? Okay, I don't know what happened.
Yeah, my business Victory.
Oh, go ahead.
My business is Victory from Chaos. I have two Facebook groups, Factually Innocent and Injustice Reform and Reentry. I'm not quite sure if I'm going to fit in the next time because I have been the victim of racism and I am white. So I wish everybody well. I wish everybody the best. Absolutely.
Sandy, can you expand on that a little bit? What's happened?
Do you know, at this point, Leona, I'm not comfortable with that because I have been reached out to by several nonprofit organizations as I am all businesslike, I have unfortunately been the product of racism. I would like to smack my black hand against your tiny white ass. So, you know,
that was them.
I understand.
That's not us. That was them. That's not us.
Yeah, really.
We're talking about modern day slavery as a people, not as a race. We're talking about black, white, Mexican. This has nothing to do with race at all.
I would like to know how many panelists that were on this show tonight have been slaves.
Okay.
Well, I would like to know that.
Can I intercede on this, I want to thank you for having these guests on. Today was the most important. I mean, it was very interesting listening to all of you. Lawrence, I want to thank you for having the show. And I'm telling you, we're going to stay focused on what you want to get out there. This whole thing about racism, I don't know where this is coming from, and I don't like it. So I want to, within this show today, I mean, I know racism is out there. I mean, we're all victims of it. But we don't need to be bringing up things that don't even make sense at the end of the show. But I want to thank you so much, Lawrence, for having the show today. And I look forward to the future ones that you have, because you brought on the right guests. Their stories were very, I mean, just like your own. It was sad. And I want that to get out there more. But thank you so much, Lawrence. And I enjoy having you on as the host of this Sunday show.
Absolutely.
I really do. So we have.
Wait to hear about Star. She's doing great.
Well,
Star's going to be on next week. I'm going to make sure she gets her message
like
out.
If you understand that 13th Amendment and you understand that legal loophole, that is exactly what it is. They told him, you will become a slave again involuntarily. Not racial, but anybody.
Star, let
what
me sign.
From,
kind of
that is you know, black people. And then it trickles down. That's
I
why
love
we're
you guys.
Star, let
we
me
are now, we are now we're not getting ready to close. So, Star, I'd like to talk to you sometime, too. I haven't met you, and I haven't heard much about you, but I would like to, if Lawrence can give you my phone number or email address. Thank you so much, and we are out of time now. So, again, as Lawrence said, next Sunday, same time, 3:30 p.m. Eastern time, which is, I think it's 12:30 California time. But thank you all so much. And Lawrence, thank you so much. You've been a blessing, I'm telling you.
Thank you.
Anytime, likewise.
Thank you. And
bye,
just
everyone.
One last thing. I'm so sorry, but I just got to add, God says set his people free. I just had to say that. God says that, and we must set our people free. Much love to all of you.
Amen.
Yeah.
Much love. All right, bye, guys.
Much.
Thank you, guys, for the opportunity.
Every time, brother. Love you.
All right.